Chema. So this is a reflection on divine love, not just love, but divine love. And just to give a little background, there is a word which is called, known as oneness in English. It's a spiritual experience of oneness. And very often it's misconstrued unless you have the original experience. It is understood as seeing the one as opposed to the many. But as the Isha Upanishad points out, that's a kind of darkness. By opposed, I mean that there is the one divine and there is this world. Or there is the knowledge and this is all ignorance completely. So there is the one and this is the many. But oneness literally means seeing the one in the many, and how in the play that one power that gets distorted, diminished, diluted, and therefore it can be recovered even in the play. Otherwise, if there is a gulf forever, then you have to leave one and go to the other. But if this is a diminished, distorted play, limited play, then we can recover that oneness even while being in the world, because that same power is operating in the world without losing its state of oneness. So this is the background. And there is a beautiful passage which Leora has pointed out, and it's dated 10th June 1964. So it's today's date. And it's on love. And there is a question that the disciple asks. How can one direct this human love toward the ideal love, the true love? So it's so relevant, because I think out of all the forces, mysterious forces in the world, love is the most mysterious, the most fascinating, the most misunderstood, and I may add the most distorted. So Mother replies, there is only one true love. It is the divine love. So she starts by saying, very clear, it's the origin and there is only one love. So again, she is not saying love of the divine. She is saying divine love. It's the origin. It is the love. So what about other loves? All other loves are diminutions, limitations and deformations of that love. So what limits, deforms and diminishes it? It's the veil of ignorance, it's the play of ego, and it's the intrusion of desire and attachment. These are the things which diminish, distort and limit it. Even the love of the bhakta for his God is a diminution and often is tainted by egoism. So it is known in Indian literature as bhakti ka ahankar. And there are several ways in which there can be egoism in bhakti. So one of them is that I am a greater bhakta, I am a greater sadhak, I am a greater servant of the Lord, I am a greater devotee. There is a very interesting story about it of Narada and Hanuman, worth remembering always. And Narada somehow, you know, feels that everybody regards Hanuman as such a great devotee. But actually, I am such a devotee of the Lord. I am living in Vaikuntha. What else? So he goes and asks the Lord that I am living in your highest status with you. And Hanuman is struggling with your struggling aspect there. So am I not the greatest devotee? You had written some book somewhere where was the name of the greatest devotees. So Vishnu Bhagavan says, yes, yes, there is something like that. Okay, please can you show me? So he shows him. And the moment Narada sees that the list of those who love the Lord the most, and he sees on top Narada, Hanuman is some third or fourth, he rushes down and says, see, Hanumanji, I told you that I am the greatest devotee of the Lord. And Hanuman says, it doesn't matter, I am not in competition. Spirituality is not a field of competition or of ambition, that who has what. I am content with my bhakti and I want to love the divine more and more and serve the divine more and more. So that doesn't quite please Narada. And Narada goes back and he tells the Lord that, see, what an arrogant person. Now see, human mind interprets what it wants to see. He said, no, Narada, you are in a little bit of a hurry. You are always in a hurry because you have the gift of, wandering. Narada has got the curse, by the way, that he will never be staying at one place. So perforce, he has to see God everywhere. So he's always wandering, vanishing, appearing here and there. So he says, I was going to show you something else you didn't see. He says, what is it? He says, you saw that register in which the names of devotees who love Lord the most. But I have another register where it is the name of devotees whom the Lord loves the most. And in that list, it is Hanuman on top. So one is that this is one kind of egoism in bhakti. Other is, my guru is the greatest. My God is the greatest. Yes, for you, yes, he is Parabrahman. He is the supreme. But the moment people begin to, from there comes conversion. From there comes fanaticism. From there comes all the ills that we see in religions. Ultimately, it goes on to that point that only if you follow my guru, you have a right to live. So we have to be very careful. These lines are very thin. So Nalinda has written a very beautiful article on fidelity to the path and sectarianism. Then another kind of egoism which can appear in bhakti, that I will be the sole custodian and guardian. That we see in the story of Ravan. So Ravan wants to take the Lord and keep him in his city and maybe charge tax from people, but he would be regarded as the custodian, middleman through whom alone people can go because you are a great devotee. And so we see how he falls. So there are this egoism in love can be very dangerous. Sri Aurobindo points out even in Essays on the Gita that a kind of blind bhakti which is not illumined has its own pitfalls and dangers. So egoism. So she says, even the love of the bhakta for his God is a diminution and often is tainted by egoism. And of course we have one angle through which we see and we cannot see the rest of it. But as one tends quite naturally to become like what one loves, the bhakta, if he is sincere, begins to become like the divine whom he adores, and thus his love becomes purer and purer. So we should be so careful. Whomever we love, we'll tend to become like that person or consciousness of that person. So when one loves the divine, automatically one begins to develop into the consciousness of the divine. So here also we have the story of Indra and there is a character with whom Indra goes after Kuts. So Kuts and Indra go in their chariot after the Devasur Sangram to celebrate the victory. And on the way, Indra is having a discussion with Kuts. He's a king. His king is also a sage, Kuts Sangira. So they are going, discussing together nice things, pleasantries, war is over. And as they come to the gates, now Kuts begins to appear just like Indra. So much so that even the guardians of the heaven, they cannot distinguish. So they have to call Sachi. Sachi is consciousness of truth, to differentiate. And she knows the difference between Indra and Kuts. So we begin to grow in the likeness of one we love, and that's why bhakti. Long back I remember in, I think, Nathdwara temple somewhere, one of their head priest asked, he said, why does God want us to do bhakti for him? Which was very odd, because a priest asking this was very strange to me. So I said, God doesn't want your bhakti for his sake. He is giving you a chance to become like him through a shortcut route. So if you have love for the divine, you'll grow into the likeness of the divine. So it is to your benefit Bhakti is prescribed to your benefit. Doesn't make a difference to God whether you love him or you don't love him, because his job description is that he will continue to love. He doesn't love the righteous and discard the sinner. That's not how God's operating system works. But there is a very nice poem of Mirabai where he says that, you know what, Lord, you don't ever be cross with me. And then she gives a very nice reason for it. I'll tell these two lines in her song, then I'll translate in English. So the lines are, Raja Ruthe Nagri Rakhe, Hari Rutha Kaha Jaso. She says that if the king is unhappy, the people in the city will keep me. They'll hide me, or some other city I can go. But if Hari is not pleased with me, where will I go? Of course, nowhere one can go other than the divine, because the divine is everywhere and in everything. That is the next stage of bhakti. So this is where that bhakta begins to grow in the likeness of the divine. So bhakti is the shortest path, the swiftest route to the divine. To adore the divine in the one whom one loves has often been suggested as a solution. So then now the question was that how can we, in human love, how to translate it? So in bhakti it becomes very easy. So she is suggesting to adore the divine in the one whom one loves has often been suggested as a solution. But unless one's heart and thought are very pure, it can lead to deplorable abasements. So that is the concept of sati in Indian thought, where strangely, because it was understood that probably man can never love this way, he is not capable by nature. But a woman can love, possibly, more centered in the heart, more intuitive. So it was that doesn't matter who the man is, he may even be a donkey, for that matter. But if you really love with this idea that God dwells in him, you can really grow into that likeness of not the donkey but the God hidden. But the whole point is, yeah, it's very difficult because your heart has to be very pure. Why she is using the word pure? Because, well, nothing you want, nothing you expect. And purity also means that you are moved by the spirit of truth and dharma inside, and your love is unconditional without any expectation. So if one can do that, it's possible. But she says, normally what happens, we love the outer surface personality and say we are loving the person because we are loving God in the person. So we are fooling. And what happens in the process? Because we are loving actually only the outer personality of the person, we are crushing all the reactions that are coming inside. We have to see God. So the result is deplorable abasements, because we begin to grow into the likeness of that, you know, whatever asuric temperament is. One example in history of such a love, where one loved the person from the deepest inner poise, with purity. There are two examples in Indian thought. One of them is Vali's wife Tara, and the other is Ravan's wife Mandodari. Their love was completely untainted, and therefore they are regarded among the five great women whose remembering whom itself is supposed to be purifying, because they have purified themselves by the power of love. That's why to remember them is purifying. But she cautions us, very true, it leads to various abasements. There is one more aspect just in the passing before we read that last master punch of the mother, is we can love something of the divine quality in the person. Everybody has some divine quality. In someone it may be brutal honesty, even stark honesty, which you may not like, but it's there. In somebody else it may be care. In somebody else something or the other, because divine quality is present in everyone, manifestation, one way or the other. That's the whole principle of the thousand names of Aditya, thousand names of Vishnu. So you can discover something of the divine aspect in any human being, and you can take that as the hold, foothold to love the divine presence in the person. But as he has said, it can be pretty dangerous. So what is the other way? Finally, she says, very simple and beautiful. It would seem that in your situation, we can remove the word why and say our situation, because all of us have someone or the other whom we love and who love us. It would seem that in your situation, the best solution would be to use your mutual attachment to unite your efforts in a common and combined aspiration to attain the divine. So practical. That's what we see in one of the plays of the mother, The Ascent to Truth. That instead of fighting, quarrel, satisfaction of desire or the dissatisfaction, joined together in supporting each other's journey towards the divine. This is a fantastic scenario if this can take place. Of course, if this takes place, if this can take place where two people support each other's journey at every level toward the divine rather than dragging them down, then it is something beautiful. So she says the best solution would be to use your mutual attachment to unite your efforts in a common and combined aspiration to attain the divine, and in perfect sincerity, to let each bring to the other, as far as possible, what the other needs to attain that goal. So it could be various kinds of needs. It could be financial need, to support the physical journey. It could be need in terms of work. It could be even an emotional need. It could be an intellectual need. It could be a complementarity of togetherness. The question is, what if that is also not possible? Then, basically, it means that the relationship inwardly has snapped. It has become dated. Then you have to just live with that acceptance, trust in the divine, detach yourself inside, give yourself fully. Be thankful to the mother that she has made you free inwardly. But otherwise, the best case scenario is in human love, to help each other. There is attachment. She is not saying become detached. She is saying turn the mutual attachment into supporting each other's, helping each other's spiritual journey and taking care of the need which is required for that goal. Not need means buying a wardrobe. She is not saying that. So I'll just read this part again. It would seem that in your situation, the best solution would be to use your mutual attachment to unite your efforts in a common and combined aspiration to attain the divine, and in perfect sincerity to let each bring to the other, as far as possible, what the other needs to attain that goal. So this is very beautiful. This is dated 10th June 1964. This is from Collected Works of the Mother, Volume 16. Namaste.